would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Good morning, everyone. Today, I am visiting with Rachel. Rachel is my colleague, and we have worked in palliative care for many years. We don't get out of our house too often because we work from home. So today, I've asked her to have coffee with me over Zoom and have a conversation. And of course, like nurses, we have to pick a topic that is important and relevant. So April is Advanced Care Planning Month, and April 16th is actually the celebratory day. So Rachel and I are going to have a conversation about informed consent and advanced care planning over coffee. And as you see, Rachel is her usual comedic self and has a lovely sparkly microphone. So speak into the microphone then, Rachel, and maybe you could introduce the topic.
Thank you, Linda. I appreciate being here today and talking about something that is near and dear to my heart. And I hope after having a little bit of time with you today, it will be near and dear to your heart and something that you maybe bring up at different conversations with friends and families, dinner tables, you know, visits on special occasions, et cetera, because there's always an opportunity to talk to family about what their wishes and priorities are as far as, you know, future decision-making. I personally love talking about ACP. We plan for many things in our life. And what things do we normally plan for? Vacations. We plan for lots of great, exciting things. And just like it requires planning to plan for trips and vacations and outings and make sure you have all the equipment and supplies that you need, you need to plan for the things that are not so great. And actually, sometimes planning for those occasions that we know are going to be coming, you know, require even more prioritization and making sure that the things are in place that we're going to need. And specifically, I'm talking about our end of life and when we can't make decisions for ourselves.
Right. So you and I know that only 10% of people die suddenly. But I'm sure, just like everyone, we all have stories of when advanced care planning has not occurred, what sort of actually disasters that we can get into and why it's so important that we deal with these things.
100%. We could, honestly, Linda, I think we could probably have hours and hours of a conversation around coffee about scenarios that didn't go well because the planning pieces weren't there.
Exactly. So maybe to start off, could you tell us what is informed consent and why is that important?
Sure. So from my perspective, you know, if you were to be injured and couldn't make a decision for yourself as far as what your healthcare plans would be or what you would or would not want done, who would you want to speak to? So it's that question in itself, you know, that you need to be asking yourself. In Ontario, the law requires that all healthcare providers get consent from either the individual who the procedure is being done on or for, or from somebody who's delegated as their substitute decision maker. That consent is either given yes, or the consent is refused no. But informed consent needs to be provided before any sort of treatment is done. And it is the responsibility of the person who is actually doing the treatment that is the one who obtains the consent. So a lot of times it's thought that the nurses are obtaining consent because they bring the document in for the patient to sign, but that's not actually accurate. The consent occurs in advance to that, in which the prescriber is the one who explains the pros and cons, explains the detail of the task or procedure or treatment that's going to be done, and the expected outcomes. And so all the minute details of that task or treatment needs to be shared and emphasized in order for the person who's making consent to be able to say yes or no to that decision. There are some key elements that are required for that, which are very important to include.
So would you be then discussing what you're talking about or alluding to? Is that what is needed to have informed consent? Is that what you're talking about?
So say you're in a situation in which, you know, you have to make a decision for yourself as far as the treatment goes, or you're making a decision for a loved one who no longer has the capacity to do that. It is important for you as a decision maker to know these specific things. So we want to make sure that the individual who's making the decision has control over the level of detail that they received. You need to be aware of all the elements of that decision. So the pros, the cons, what's going to happen, how long it's going to take, all that, who, what, where, how, when, why. All those specific details you want to be aware of so that you can make a decision based on knowledge. It's important to ensure that the individual, the person making the decision, has a clear opportunity to say yes or no to that treatment or intervention. And it is important to consider the individual and the person's perspective on that. So to be able to provide opportunity to answer questions as questions arise. And it's also important to know that giving consent or informed consent is an ongoing process. So at any point, consent can be withdrawn. At any point, consent can be altered in any way.
Right. And so obviously you and I have been educated for many years on advanced care planning and informed consent. So there are some assumptions that the public makes about informed consent. Could you maybe describe those for me?
Sure. So as in all things, there are many assumptions and not all assumptions are correct ones. So around advanced care planning and goals of care decision-making, a lot of people make some decisions or make the assumption that their family will take care of them, that family and friends will all agree and make caregiving decisions that throughout their illness trajectory that are in line with what they would want done and what they would not want done, that their family members have a very clear understanding of what specifically is a priority for them. And they also have an assumption that home care will be available to the extent that they need it when they need it. And the reality is, we are a mobile society. Many family members don't live in the same town. Many family members don't have a clue as to what would be a priority for the individual that they're making a decision about. The reality is that despite all good intentions, sometimes making decisions for a family member that's no longer competent is the breaking point for that family and can totally create a rift and barricades between loved ones, especially when loved ones are not on the same page or don't have the same interpretation or understanding of what their family member would or would not want done. And the biggest assumption really is that today in our mobile society, that home care would be available when we need it and to the extent that we need it. This is not always accurate. You know, the nature of our healthcare today is in a state of adaptation, transformation. And so there's qualifiers in which you need to meet in order to be able to have home care. in a certain place at a certain time at a certain level. And so there's no guarantees at the time in which you're going to need it. It's going to be available and to the extent that you do.
Right. And so we also know that even if you meet all the qualifications to actually have home care, that sometimes there just aren't the service providers.
Exactly.
Do the care.
For sure. For sure. So, you know, even right now in our healthcare, the way it is right now, we have health human resource shortages all over the place. You know, so the care is available. There's funding for the care. We know people need it, but there are no bodies in those positions to be able to meet the need that is required. So it's not so much a funding issue or an issue that the service is not available because of funding. The service is not available because there's no staff members in those positions. There's vacancies in healthcare all over the place.
And then the care then falls down to the family, which is often a major difficulty based on families' lifestyles and having to work and so on.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in our roles as palliative care nurses, albeit we're not frontline, we are more educators and coaching and mentoring service providers, we know that there's common desires of those that are dying and what they wish for. Can you tell me what you think those are?
Sure. So I know personally, you know, some of the desires that I would have, or that I want to ensure that my loved one who was going to be making a decision for me at one point, or would possibly have to make a decision for me, would be things like, you know, how long would I want to live if I was in a disabled state? At what extent of disability would be considered suffering for me? What would I want done in certain situations if the outcome was going to be such, or at what point would be too much for me or not quality enough based on what is important to me? So, you know, sometimes people have desires such as, I want to live forever. I want to be healthy. I want to be happy. Sometimes people say, I want to be fully able and then die suddenly in my sleep. Wouldn't that be a dream? Some are more realistic and more practical and say, you know, biggest priority for me is I want to be able to die at home, in the comforts of my own home, in my own space. I don't want to be in an acute care center. I don't want to be in a long-term care home, a retirement home, et cetera. So if at all possible, please allow me to be in comforts of my own space. You know, another priority for another would be, I want to be pain-free. I'm sure that's a big one for absolutely everyone. Or I want to have my symptoms managed as best as they possibly can. And as healthcare providers working in palliative care, this is very doable. You know, and it's about sharing what your desires are to make sure that individuals will be able to, you know, meet that need who are on our care team.
So now that we're talking about our desires and making them known, can you describe what is advanced care planning in Ontario? And we're going to specifically talk about Ontario because the law may be different, or expectations may be different in other provinces.
Sure. So I'll just speak to Ontario. So advanced care planning has two main components to it. It's about talking about personal values and wishes with your family and friends. And by understanding what gives you meaning, guides you in your future health and personal care preferences. And it's about identifying who will speak on your behalf if you are no longer mentally capable, and that person is your substitute decision maker.
So advanced care planning is one of your favorite topics, like you mentioned, and your colleagues also know that's one of your favorite topics.
I could talk for hours.
Yes. Why is advanced care planning important? Not just to you, but for everyone.
So to me, you know, advanced care planning provides a gift to our family members, or really a gift to that person who's making decisions for us. Because you're providing them with the information about our personal values and wishes. You're providing them with all the information that they possibly need to be able to make a decision on our behalf. We're not forcing them to make a guess or an educated guess. We're actually fueling them with information so that they are able to make a decision based on knowledge about us, we're taking the guessing game out of it. So to me, that's a gift. The worst thing that can happen is when, you know, we set somebody up for failure. And this is setting somebody up for success in making those decisions for us.
So I just have one question that's kind of not on our what we talked about. So give me one example of, in your advanced care plan, and we're going to talk in a minute about a substitute decision maker, but what is one kind of awkward, unique thing that you would ask your substitute decision maker to do for you?
What I would want them to know?
Yeah, one kind of funny thing.
Okay, so one sort of funny thing is I am always cold. And I always like to have my neck covered. Like, I'm in a turtleneck.
Yes.
And so, you know, the people or the person that is making decisions for me, and I know it's simple, but it is a priority for me. You know, if I was to ever have to be in acute care for any period of time, you know, we know it's cold in there.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure that, you know, they know that how important it is for me to be in something cozy and comfortable that covers me. You know, I know it seems simple and it's not an actual decision-making piece that's huge, but as far as comfort and quality for me, if I need to be cozy in my environment, I can be anywhere that I need to be in order to get the care that I need. I can be in acute care for an extended period of time if that's what it takes to, and I'm going to have a recovery, but please make sure I'm comfortable. You know, make sure I'm wrapped up, make sure I'm in a nice, you know, warm blanket, or, you know, I have socks on my feet or mitts on my hands. You know, I want to be warm.
That's a fantastic example. Mine is, if I can't wear high-heeled shoes, then could someone please bring me a pair of high-heeled slippers?
As long as you're bed-bound, that will be fine. But
yes.
You know, physio's getting you up, it might not work.
So we talked a little bit about if we had these requests to our substitute decision maker, can you explain what that person actually is?
Sure. So a decision maker is the person who's delegated to make a decision for us when we're no longer capable. The only time that comes into play is if we are no longer capable. So if cognitively something has happened, and we're not able to make decisions, or, you know, we're incapacity, unresponsive for a period of time or an extended period of time. And a substitute decision maker can make a decision for us at one point in time. And then after we recover or we're competent again, then we make the decisions for ourselves. So it can come and go. So that substitute decision maker must be willing to make decisions for us on our behalf. They must be available to make those decisions when and if needed. And they must be capable of providing that consent. They do have to be 16 years of age or older, and there has to be sure that there is no separation agreement or any divorce decree or anything like that that severs that relationship prior to consent being able to be provided.
So in Ontario, there's a hierarchy of who can be a substitute decision maker if you haven't actually assigned one. So could you review that for us?
Sure. So at the top of the, so if somebody hasn't assigned a power of attorney personally for healthcare decision making, then there, as you said, Linda, there is a hierarchy. And so it's important to know that what that hierarchy is and who's at the top of the list, to be sure that that is the person that would automatically be that decision maker for you. Because if you don't want it to be that person on the hierarchy, then you're best to put in some paperwork that specifically assigns someone as your power of attorney for personal care. So the hierarchy at the top of the list is the guardian of the person. And then next on the list would be, you know, the power of attorney for personal care. So as I said, that's a specific document that you delegate someone being responsible for that. Next under that would be a representative appointed by the Ontario Consent and Capacity Board. So if in fact there isn't a power of attorney assigned and there isn't somebody who's able to make those judgment decisions, there's no spouse or partner or anything like that, or there's been some legal issues and the courts have intervened, then the representative is in place above anybody else. Under that would be your spouse or partner. And they could be married to each other or living in a marriage-like relationship, have lived together for over a year. And then next under that are, or within that same header actually, are child and parent are actually children. So if, for instance, something happens to me and I don't have a power of attorney signed for myself, then my hierarchy would be my mom as well as my grown children. All of those, my three children and my mom, would be on the same level of decision making. And the assumption is everybody has to be on the same page as to, you know, what I would want done and what I wouldn't want done. So in my situation, it would be most appropriate if I actually assigned a power of attorney for personal care so that I'm delegating one specific person or a couple specific people to make that decision for me, because there's no guarantee all of those people are going to be on the same page and have the same understanding of what I would want.
Right. And in our backgrounds from either community nursing or managing people or say working in a hospice, we know that four people in the same family, the chances of being on the same page are almost non-existent, and it does cause some major difficulties that we could sit and at the time the stories are not very pleasant.
That's right. And you have to take into consideration too, you know, family members have different relationships with that loved one, and the dynamics of their relationship are very, very different. Even if you're, you know, from the same family, there might be some individuals who are closer in proximity, but not closer emotionally. Some that are farther distance away may have a better understanding or more of an intimate understanding of what the wishes of their loved one would be. But another person is more responsible for, you know, the activities of daily living or some of the IADLs, like, you know, I grocery shop for my mom all the time, but I don't have a clue as to what she would want as far as her end of life planning. So, you know, there's different dynamics and changes in everybody's relationship. And you have to take into consideration when you're assigning someone as your power of attorney, what healthcare decisions this person would be responsible for. So, you know, some of those things are consents to tests, procedures, surgeries, whether you want to begin or withdraw, life prolonging measures, who will provide the medical care. So the decision making as to who's going to be on your team, what physicians, what nurse practitioners are you going to see, are you going to be involved with? Whether you're being admitted or discharged from medical facilities, your substitute decision maker needs to be involved in those decisions, because these are consent to treatments and interventions and all healthcare planning discussions. So it's a huge responsibility, and there's a vast variety of decisions that need to be made when you're in that responsible position. And it is a responsible position.
So what you've just described then would basically cover the requirements and the decisions that would face a substitute decision maker.
Yeah, like, so based on, you know, what we've learned about the hierarchy of substitute decision makers, you can choose a different substitute decision maker or power of attorney for personal care. And then you also can assign someone power of attorney for your finances. There are two very different things, two very different decision-making responsibilities, and who you're choosing for your personal care, which is really what we're talking about here today. You know, you want to make sure that they have a good understanding of what would be a priority for you, because they're not making decisions from their perspective. They're making decisions on your behalf, based on your perspective. All they're doing is being your voice, because you don't have a voice at that point in time.
Right. So it's really important to choose someone who will actually do that rather than put in their own emotions and values about how to make the decision.
For sure. And if there's any takeaways from our conversation today, I think that really is a priority. You need to make sure that whoever it is who's speaking on your behalf has the strength in their voice and the strength in their heart and their mind to be able to speak what is a priority for you, even though it might be difficult for them because they wish you could say it's a decision about withdrawing life support. You know, as difficult as it would be to be making that decision, and you'd want that person to be here in life for as long as they possibly could, if the conversation in advance was you wouldn't want, you know, to live in that condition, then it's the responsibility of that substitute decision maker to speak on your behalf, even though it may create some cognitive dissonance on their behalf and some emotional turmoil. They still need to speak on your behalf, as difficult as that would be, because they're making a decision that you wanted them to make, not the decision they want to make.
So it has to be, like you said, someone who has the strength to be able to carry that through.
That's right. Yeah. And it's not easy at all.
And can you explain the components of person-centered decision-making? Because that's important in advanced care planning.
So person-centered healthcare decisions. So there's the person and then there's the treatment. So the person involves values and goals, and then the treatment involves information and evidence. So you have to take into consideration the treatment that's being offered and take into consider the values and the goals of the individual, put them together, and based on how they interact and what comes up as a priority, pros and cons, you know, goals and values, what can be done, what can't be done, what falls in alignment with the person's values and goals lines up, then a decision is made. So the decision for all things has to take into consideration the person as well as the treatment. You can't just consider the treatment without the person's values and goals, because then you would be doing things that that person would not want done.
So that's why it's important. And that's why we say advanced care planning, for exactly that reason, right?
Exactly. And what decision one person would make in one situation is not necessarily the decision that another person would make in that same situation, because within us are different values, beliefs, goals, priorities. You know, there's so many elements that come into play when someone is making a decision for themselves. It's not just, you know, oh, what's the treatment? Yeah, let's go for it. It's about, you know, what will that treatment provide? What other things am I dealing with at this same time? What will the outcome go? How will it impact me in the future? What is the quality of my life if I have it, if I don't have it? All those circumstances come into play and are what impacts and what determines what our values are and what our goals are. And what the decision would be to whether, you know, say yes to a treatment decision or say no, that's not something that I want at this time.
And there's an actual process that a person goes through to make healthcare decisions. Could you maybe explain what that process looks like?
Sure. So as you said, there is a process for advanced care planning. So, you know, the first step is to identify values and wishes that contribute to quality of life. So you can ask yourself when you're thinking about this topic is, you know, what do you worry about most when it comes to your future health? What's your favorite routine or habit? Who's most likely to know what you're thinking? What makes your life meaningful? You know, is it spending time with friends, experiencing new cultures, traveling, skiing, vacationing, reading, listening to music, whatever it may be? What life circumstances would you find most unbearable? Who do you go to first for advice? Maybe that's the person you're going to assign as your substitute decision maker. What's your favorite ceremony? What's your favorite special event? So those are all things that you want to identify as wishes and beliefs. The next step would be to learn about healthcare options and medical procedures. So, you know, if you're diagnosed with a life-limiting illness, there's many medical procedures and influences on your personal health that would impact decision-making in the future. It's important to take into consideration or have a little bit of knowledge around some of those decisions that a loved one would be making for you in the future if you couldn't make those decisions. You know, what level of impairment are linked with certain illnesses, the quality of life, how those different illnesses impact quality of life. You know, are these conditions reversible? How are they impacted by different treatment interventions? all of that sort of thing. It's nice to know a little bit of information about those so that you're making decisions with knowledge. The next step, as you know, very important in advanced care planning, is determine your substitute decision maker. And so we've talked about why it's so important to do that. And, you know, beyond deciding who the substitute decision maker is going to be, you need to have a conversation with that individual.
Oh, yeah. No surprises. No surprises.
Exactly. So for instance, Linda, you know, we've known each other a long time. If I was, you know, and I believe you would make a competent decision for me in a situation like this, but I can't just, you know, delegate you or assign you on a sheet of paper as my substitute decision maker. I need to make sure that you're aware of that and that we have a conversation that I've assigned that responsibility to you in the event that you need it. Because you do have the ability to be able to say, Rachel, I honestly don't think I'm comfortable making that decision for you or speaking on your behalf because, or it provides you with the opportunity to come to me and say, I'm honored to be that person for you. Can we have more of a conversation about what your goals and values would be to be sure that I'm making the decision that's best for you when I have to step up and do that for you? So yeah, that's it, so works important. In two ways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I would be honored, actually. So can you tell us what the process of advanced care planning is versus what it is not? And that may help some people understand.
So advanced care planning is reflecting and communicating your values and beliefs and your goals of care. It's planning for a time when you can't make treatment decisions on your own. It's discussing with family, friends, and healthcare providers what your goals are and determining or appointing a substitute decision maker as a power of attorney for your personal care. It's about sharing your wishes. So an assumption is that, you know, advanced care planning is a one-time conversation, and once you have it, then it's done. That's not correct. That's not what advanced care planning is. It's not a one-time conversation. And it's not only about treatment options with a physician or a healthcare provider. It's really about goals and wishes. Some people, advanced care planning isn't consent to treatment. So advanced care planning, as the name suggests, is done in advance. It's about having a discussion about your care, what you would want done. It's not about treatment decisions. The advanced care planning piece, the conversations that you've had with loved ones about your goals and your wishes, are what guides decision-making and what guides a consent for treatment. But advanced care planning in itself is not consent to treatment. And it is not the strict refusal of medical treatment. So, you know, it may feed the decision-making for refusing certain treatments, but it's not a way of saying, I want nothing done or I want everything done. That is not what advanced care planning is all about. And it is not a document, form, or checklist to be completed. So here in Ontario, in some other locations, I think in the States, they have things like living wills where people can actually write lists of items that they would and would want done. And, you know, they're legally binding. Here in Ontario, that's not what we do. Our advanced care planning is about a discussion and about assigning someone to make a decision for us. So if, yes, you're more than welcome to write it down, but you can't bring in what you've written down or give that written list to someone and say, you know, if anything happens to me, give this to my prescriber. That's not how it works. Always a conversation will be had, but you can have that document that your loved one gave to you as a resource for you when you're making those decisions, but that is not a binding document.
It's not binding. It's just a guide, and yes, those conversations can change, and so can whatever we've written on the piece of paper as time goes on.
100%. And, you know, and the decision I may make in my 50s right now, you know, as far as, you know, I'd want this done, this done, this one, this is a priority for me, and please do this, but don't do this, might be very different than what it will be when I'm 70. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing discussion.
Yeah. And so besides our conversation today, there's many, many resources that we can find that are beneficial in assisting in learning about advanced care planning and informed consent. Could you go, maybe go over a few of the ones that we use that we think are good ones and that are beneficial?
So I think, you know, it's important to start the conversation now while we're healthy. So do not wait until there's a crisis situation, because then it's additional stress. You're not thinking clearly. You're in a rush. It's just not ideal for so many reasons. And I know I haven't mentioned nearly all of those reasons, but there are many. So, you know, if you have the opportunity, do it now. You know, you want to be specific in defining what different things mean to you. So you want to consider dignity and what dignity means to you. So in my position, you know, if I think about what dignity is and I want my dignity to be maintained, I want to be clean. I want to be tidy. I want my environment to be clean and safe and tidy. That's what a priority is for me. I want to be respected. I don't want to be treated in an aggressive way, you know. And then independence. I want to think about, you know, what independence means to me. And, you know, if that is altered in some way, you know, things to consider. So to me, independence is mobility. So if my mobility is impaired, that alters my quality of life. If I'm not able to make choices for myself, that impairs my independence. Independence is very important to me. If I'm not able to care for myself, dress myself, toilet myself, feed myself, those are independent features that are so important to me. And if I'm not able to do that for myself, then my quality of life will significantly be impaired. My personal abilities. So what does ability mean to me? I want to be able to communicate with family. I want to be able to see my family, maybe not face-to-face, but on a virtual format of some sort. I want to be able to hear them. I want to be able to enjoy a meal with them. And if I can't eat, maybe they can have a meal around me, but still be in my presence. So some of those things are very important, and quality of life in general. And all those other features sort of tie into quality of life. So I want my privacy to be upheld. I want to be as pain-free and symptom-free as possible. And I don't want to feel like I'm a burden to my loved ones. So, you know, if I'm ever in a state in which I'm feeling that way, then I want to be able to have the opportunity for certain decisions to be made so that I'm not going to be living in that sort of situation with my quality of life impacted as such. That's not acceptable to me.
Great. And on the internet, there's actually a booklet or a guide that can be filled out. The website is Advanced Care Planning Canada, and that has replaced the website of Speak Up Ontario, correct?
I think it's Advanced Care Planning Ontario, not Canada.
Oh, okay.
Because Advanced Care Planning rules, regulations differ from province to province. Sometimes the language that they use for different documents or different phrases that they use are different from province to province. So I think it used to be called Speak Up Ontario. Now it's called Advanced Care Planning Ontario.
Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So a lot of the content in those booklets is exactly the same. They've just changed the name. And it's a great, great website. Lots of different resources. There are some YouTube videos there that help explain what advanced care planning is and how to initiate some of those conversations. And, you know, really it's about having the conversation. So talking about the elephant in the room, because 100% of us die. None of us escape it. When and how is variable. But, you know, everyone needs to be having these conversations.
Exactly. So important. So obviously the month of April is Advanced Care Planning Month, like we said, and April 16th is the specific day. So I want to thank you, Rachel, for joining me to have this conversation that's so important. And I just thought of something a little bit funny that people might remember it by. So you have that lovely sparkly microphone. So everybody speak up for advanced care planning into a sparkly microphone and get people to hear you because it's so very important.
Exactly. And, you know, as nurses, we, you know, there's no issues about having certain conversations in certain places, you know, everything goes. And so, you know, It's even if you can print off some of those documents and, you know, bring them over to, say, your parents' place or your siblings' place when you're going over for your next family gathering and leave them on the coffee table, and somebody stumbles across them and they're like, what's this? You know, then you can spark the conversation. Leave it in the bathroom, you know, on top of the other magazines that are sitting there when you're sitting there reading. You know, there's so many different opportunities to trigger those, some of those conversations, even when you're traveling with your grown children or even your younger children for that matter. You know, they're an audience that is stuck in your car for a period of time. It's a great opportunity to engage in some of these conversations and to just start off by saying, you know, talk about something that you read in the paper about someone who was on life support for an extended period of time, or, you know, some of the current issues dealing with things like that. Accidents happen all the time. You know, you can use examples like that and say, you know, if that ever happened to me, this would be a priority for me. You can make those conversations relevant. You don't have to sit down, make an appointment, have a meeting and say, I want you to tell me what you want in this situation and what you don't want. It can be a very natural conversation. Even when you're grocery shopping, or, you know, or another loved one has had a health issue, you can say, remember what happened to Aunt Marie? You know, if you were in that situation, Mom, what would you want done? Or what is a priority for you? Or have you and Dad ever had conversations about this? That allows you conversations to get to know that individual on a more intimate level.
Okay, Rachel, well, I want to say thank you. And of course, we'll be doing our work through the month of April. And so thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome, Linda. Thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
Okay, we'll talk
soon. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.